Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the broadcast. I'm Tracy McClure with you over the next half hour. Coming up today, our resident Vatican watcher Joan Lewis takes a look back over the Pope's activities this past week. But first, our weekly reflection on the Gospel reading in Jill Bevilacqua's program, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. Let's listen.
Jesus said to the Pharisees, "Once there was a rich man who dressed in purple and linen and feasted splendidly every day. At his gate lay a beggar named Lazarus, who was covered with sores. Lazarus longed to eat the scraps that fell from the rich man's table. The dogs even came and licked his sores. Eventually the beggar died. He was carried by angels to the bosom of Abraham. The rich man likewise died and was buried. From the abode of the dead, where he was in torment, he raised his eyes and saw Abraham afar off and Lazarus resting in his bosom. He called out, 'Father Abraham, have pity on me. Send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water to refresh my tongue, for I am tortured in these flames.' 'My child,' replied Abraham, 'remember that you were well off in your lifetime, while Lazarus was in misery. Now he has found consolation here, but you have found torment. And that is not all. Between you and us there is fixed a great abyss, so that those who might wish to cross from here to you cannot do so, nor can anyone cross from your side to us.' 'Father, I ask you then,' the rich man said, 'send him to my father's house, where I have five brothers. Let him be a warning to them, so that they may not end in this place of torment.' Abraham answered, 'They have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them.' 'No, Father Abraham,' replied the rich man, 'but if someone would only go to them from the dead, then they would repent.' Abraham said to him, 'If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced, even if one should rise from the dead.'"
The parable of today's gospel has long been known as that of Dives and Lazarus. But while both old and present-day versions give the poor man a name, the rich man only came to be known as Dives because it was the Latin word for rich. Pope John Paul II issued an encyclical, the opening words of which were Dives Misericordiae, rich in mercy. In a 1930s dictionary, the word Dives appears with the explanation, commonly taken as the proper name of the rich man in the parable, see Luke 16, and used generically for rich man. In a present-day dictionary, it appears in capital letters with this definition, a typical or hypothetical rich man, and it's preceded by the words poetic or literary. But it adds that its origin is Middle English from Late Latin, used in the Vulgate translation of the Bible. Dives then was only fictitious, but in fact there was a Roman politician who was known as Dives because he was the richest of Roman citizens. He was a friend of Julius Caesar, and in the year 60 BC formed the first triumvirate with him and Pompey. His real name, by the way, was Marcus Licinius Crassus. But to our parable. In order to emphasise the difference between the two protagonists, Jesus presents the first as living in the lap of luxury and dressed in the finest clothes and dining on the choicest of foods, while the second languishes in abject poverty and disease. Our rich man dressed in purple, we hear. And purple is the colour we usually associate with Lent, with the sacrament of reconciliation, or penance as it was formerly called. Dating from 1466, we read, "It was the hue of mourning, especially royal or ecclesiastical mourning, or of penitence." But in ancient Greece and Rome, purple robes were a mark of dignity and were worn by kings, magistrates and military commanders. And what do we read in Mark's account of the Passion when Jesus was delivered into the hands of the Roman soldiers?
They dressed him up in purple, twisted some thorns into a crown and put it on him. And they began saluting him, "Hail, King of the Jews." They struck his head with a reed and spat on him, and they went down on their knees to do him homage. And when they had finished making fun of him, they took off the purple and dressed him in his own clothes.
In later times, born to the purple came to mean someone born into a reigning family or privileged class. But in antiquity, purple was also a symbol of power and luxury. The phrase, the purple, was a synonym for the rank of Roman emperor, from the colour of his dyed woolen robe. And from Roman times, purple has been used in the insignia of emperors, kings, and prelates. When a man's made a cardinal, in fact, we say that he has been raised to the purple, although in fact his official dress is red. But in the dictionary, purple is defined as a colour falling midway between red and blue in hue. So that explains it. The most famous purple was Tyrian purple, a dye very costly to produce. It was obtained from a mixture of shellfish, murex and purpura, mollusks related to snails and whelks and found by the Phoenician port of Tyre on the Mediterranean coast, as our traveller writes.
On the beach near Tyre, I saw the thin-coloured seashell from which in ancient times the famous Tyrian purple was made.
The Hebrews valued purple goods very highly, we read in a manual on life in Babel times, and it refers to a woman mentioned in the Acts of the Apostles.
The New Testament tells us that Lydia was a seller of purple in the city of Thyatira. Thyatira was famous for its cloth dyers, so we assume that Lydia dealt in cloth of purple and possibly in the dye itself.
Lydia was the woman Paul and his companions met by the river outside the gates of Philippi, where she and other women had gathered for prayer. In the versions of the Acts I've been looking at, Lydia's said to have been from the town of Thyatira. Today's guidebook tells us that it is a small town in western Turkey, some 100 kilometres from Smyrna. A biblical scholar writes that Thyatira was in Lydia, from which the woman takes her name. Lydia's important for us because she and her family formed the first Christian nucleus of the European continent. Philippi, a town in Macedonia in northeast Greece, was Paul's first landing point in Europe.
A prosperous city, thriving on the trade which passed along the Via Agasia, the road built by the Romans to connect Asia Minor with Italy. Following the activities of Paul, it readily abandoned its pagan gods and adopted Christianity.
Apart from the distinguishing mark of purple, the rich man in the parable is also dressed in linen. Fine linen, most other versions have. And this is an important distinction, as the manual notes.
Linen was a versatile fabric that could be made coarse and thick, or very fine and delicate. The Egyptians had a wide reputation for their fine linen, which was nearly transparent. They also made coarse linen that was so heavy that it could be used for carpets to cover the floors. Egyptians of the Nile Valley developed linen cloth, virtually the lightest of clothing materials, to offset the effects of the sweltering sun in their area. The Egyptians preferred the sheerest of linens. The fine linen fabrics were worn by those with positions of status or wealth, and the coarser fabrics were worn by the common people. The Egyptians clothed Joseph in fine linen when they made him ruler. The curtains, veil and door hangings of the Hebrew tabernacle were made of fine linen, as were the hangings for the gate of the court or for the court itself. The ephod, an apron-like garment and breastplate of the high priest, contained fine linen. The mitre or upper turban, the official headdress of the high priest, was made of fine linen and had many folds and a total length of about 8 yards. This long cloth was wound about the head in turban style. The tunic, girdle and breeches worn by all priests were made of fine white linen, and during their temple ministrations the priests also wore robes of white linen. The Jews made their inner garments or underclothing primarily of linen. The grave clothes of Jesus were made from this fabric. Joseph of Arimathea bought a shroud of linen for the purpose, writes Mark, and Joseph, buying fine linen and taking him down, wrapped him in the fine linen.
And in conclusion, we read that fine white linen was also a symbol of innocence and moral purity. And the writer refers us to the book of Revelation, where the seven angels came out wearing pure white linen, fastened round their waists with golden girdles. Back in the 19th century, a young woman of 25, Cecil Frances Alexander, published a collection of hymns for little children, which became immensely popular. One of the best known of these, All Things Bright and Beautiful, is still sung today. But there's one verse which is no longer sung. To do so would be, shall we say, at the very least, politically incorrect.
The rich man in his castle, the poor man at his gate, God made them high or lowly, and ordered their estate.
The poor man at the gate of Dives Castle was not only a beggar, but was covered with sores. Such a pitiful specimen of humanity that the dogs are moved to lick his sores. In the Bible there's a real-life Lazarus, the brother of Martha and Mary, who dies and is brought back to life by Jesus. So Lazarus was a real name. But as a result of the parable, it came to mean a beggar, or leper, or both. A proper name, used allusively, was a definition of 1508. Then there was the word Lazar, now archaic, which one modern dictionary defines as one afflicted with a repulsive disease. Lazar was simply an adaptation of the medieval Latin Lazarus, an application of the proper name Lazarus. The old dictionary defines it as a poor and diseased person, usually one afflicted with a loathsome disease, especially a leper. Our poor man was not a leper, or he would certainly not have been allowed to sit at the rich man's gate. In our Lord's time, lepers had to live at a distance from the healthy community. But even a couple of centuries ago, an isolation hospital for those with infectious diseases, especially leprosy or plague, was known as a lazaret, or lazaretto. The Lazarus in the parable longed to eat the scraps that fell from the rich man's table. But he's not allowed even that. It's a very extreme parable. Dives doesn't lift a finger to help Lazarus. And when he dies and goes to hell, he calls on Abraham to send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water so as to cool his tongue. Just the tip of his finger, no more. But he had never thought of offering Lazarus even the proverbial cup of cold water. If anyone gives so much as a cup of cold water to one of these little ones... St. John Chrysostom, 4th century Greek doctor of the Church, was brought up, we're told, in surroundings of splendour and affluence. But Maisie Ward, in her book Early Church Portrait Gallery, compared him to St. Basil the Great in his passionate love for the poor, in his hope to change the ordinary careless Christian into a man with an outlook like his own. Not only did he urge men to give freely, he attacked ill-gotten riches. But he stretched the idea of ill-gotten riches very far. Even if you had not robbed the poor yourself, were you sure about the wealth you inherited? And he demanded charity on the scale of the gospel.
You make no difficulty about boarding and lodging soldiers at the demand of the civil authority. You will not do the same for the poor at the demand of Christ. Yet the poor are your defenders against the devil, as the soldiers are against the barbarians. All of you should have guest houses in proportion to your income. Set apart a room in your dwelling for the guest, that is, for Christ. Put a servant in charge, choose the best you have, to receive the poor and sick, and to wait upon them. If you will not make this sacrifice and let Lazarus sit by your family hearth, at least shelter him in your stable. Yes. Give Christ shelter in your stable. You shudder at this idea, but it is far worse to shut the door in his face.
And let's close with an anonymous poem, or rather a ballad, entitled Dives and Lazarus.
As it fell out upon a day, rich Dives he made a feast, and he invited all his friends and gentry of the best. Then Lazarus laid him down and down, and down at Dives' door. Some meat, some drink, brother Dives, bestow upon the poor. Thou art none of my brother Lazarus that lies begging at my door. No meat nor drink will I give thee, nor bestow upon the poor. Then Lazarus laid him down and down, and down at Dives' wall. Some meat, some drink, brother Dives, or with hunger starve I shall. Then Dives sent out his merry men to whip poor Lazarus away. They had no power to strike a stroke, but flung their whips away. Then Dives sent out his hungry dogs to bite him as he lay. They had no power to bite at all, but licked his sores away. As it fell out upon a day, poor Lazarus sickened and died. Then came two angels out of heaven, his soul therein to guide. Rise up, brother Lazarus, and go along with me, for you've a place prepared in heaven to sit on an angel's knee. As it fell out upon a day, rich Dives sickened and died. Then came two serpents out of hell, his soul therein to guide. Rise up, brother Dives, and go with us to see a dismal place prepared in hell to sit on a serpent's knee. Then Dives looked up with his eyes and saw poor Lazarus blessed. Give me one drop of water, brother Lazarus, to quench my flaming thirst. Or had I as many years to abide as there are blades of grass, then there would be an end. But now hell's pains will ne'er be past. Or was I now but alive again, the space of 1/2 hour, or that I had my peace secure, then the devil should have no power.
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for that program with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett. And now our favorite Vatican watcher, Joan Lewis, is back for a peek at the past week's events here in the Vatican. Come join us in studio. This has been another whirlwind week for Pope Francis, going to Assisi.
Yes.
That was really the big highlight, I would say, of this week.
Yeah, that, of course, was on Tuesday and on the 20th. That was to commemorate the 30th anniversary of what was begun by Pope St. John Paul, in 1986, the Day of Prayer for Peace, and this is an interreligious meeting all the time. There were well over 400 religious leaders from around the world in attendance. There were actually 3 days of meetings of all these leaders on the theme Thirst for Peace, and the Holy Father more or less really closed out that entire meeting. And I was so struck by about 32 different things that he said, but if I'd had to give a headline to the meeting, I think I would have said that he said, "Peace alone and not war is holy." How often have we heard from the bad guys the expression holy war? Pope Francis said, "We never tire of repeating the name of God cannot be used to justify violence." I'd love to have a dollar for every time he said that just on Tuesday. And how many times has he said it before that? He said, "The one who calls upon God's name to justify terrorism, violence, and war does not follow God's path. War in the name of religion becomes a war against religion itself." And actually, if you look at the many other religious leaders who spoke, who were interviewed by Vatican Radio, by so many others, they all reiterated many, many times this very same fact, that war in the name of religion can never be justified, and that the world does thirst for peace. I thought this was very profound, what the Holy Father said at one point. He said, God asks us to look at achieving peace, calling us to confront the great sickness of our time, indifference. He said, this is a virus that paralyzes, rendering us lethargic and insensitive, a disease that eats away at the very heart of religious fervor, giving rise to a new and deeply sad paganism, the paganism of indifference. I mean, like, whoa.
That's a powerful image.
Yes. And then obviously the Holy Father went on to say, we can't remain indifferent. Today the world has a profound thirst for peace. And he said, in so many countries, people are suffering due to wars, which, though often forgotten, are always the cause of suffering and poverty. We heard his call, his very profound remarks, for an end to war, for an end to violence and terror in the name of religion. But again, he was just echoing the words and sentiments of all the other religious leaders there. And of course, it was a day filled with prayer for peace, and we were told never to underestimate the power of prayer, but we had prayers together by the religious leaders and then in separate locations in Assisi, the various Christians, Muslims, Jews, Buddhists, and so forth, all had their various prayer places. Of course, there was a luncheon with leaders, and there were a number of refugees present at that luncheon, too. When are people going to listen? It's like, how often do these leaders have to make this plea? Who is listening?
Well, let's go back now and look at Sunday the 18th. Pope Francis had a mass for the Vatican Gendarmerie.
That was so lovely. They were celebrating the 200th anniversary of the Corps, the Vatican Gendarmes. And I have to tell you something. I have a picture. I wish this was TV at times instead of radio. I have a wonderful picture of John the 23rd as he's carried into an audience on the Sedia Gestatoria. In the picture are two categories of Vatican people who no longer exist, those who carried the chair in with the Pope, and then what was called the Palatine Guard, which was actually the precursor to the gendarmes and their fancy uniforms and everything. But the Pope thanked, of course, the Vatican security officials for their tireless service. He warned against crimes that are connected to exploitation and corruption. Now, the Vatican gendarmes, I think our listeners probably know, they've seen them around in their blue uniforms and along with the Swiss guards at ceremonies. A lot of times they are in St. Peter's Square, not in any kind of a recognizable uniform, you know, for security places. And so the gendarme is constantly 24/7 watching over Vatican City and all the extraterritorial places to ensure security and public order, and they work to prevent and stop crime. And of course, this was established, we said, 200th anniversary, so we're talking 1816. Pope Pius VII established the gendarmes after the Congress of Vienna led to the restoration of the Papal States. And then, of course, quite a number of years after that, the Papal States went the way of history, and we looked at a reunification of Italy. At the Angelus, then, of course, from his study window, the Holy Father did mention the upcoming, at that time, Assisi trip, and he said, "Today, more than ever, we need peace in this war, which is everywhere in the world. Let us pray for peace." And he explained that he was going to Assisi in the footsteps of St. John Paul II, who called for the world a day of prayer for peace 30 years ago. And so the Holy Father asked parishes, ecclesial associations, and individual faithful across the world to participate in this event with their prayer.
And then on Monday, of course, we had Britain's new ambassador to the Holy See come in and present her credentials.
Indeed. And her name is Sally Axworthy. She has worked extensively on conflict resolution in Northern and Eastern Africa. Must have been kind of fun to be privy to a few words in their private conversation, because these are areas, obviously, that the Holy Father's interested in, too. So also Monday, we hear Cardinal Pietro Parolin's name. He is the Vatican Secretary of State, and he's going to attend. This is so significant. He's going to attend the signing of the, quote, final accord for the termination of conflict and construction of a stable and durable peace between the Colombian government and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, known as FARC, FARC, and he'll be doing that on September 26th. And then also it was announced Monday that a Holy See delegation led by Cardinal Parolin joined other world leaders in New York for a high-level summit hosted by the UN General Assembly to address issues related to large-scale movements of refugees and migrants. And then faith-based organizations were having kind of a side meeting on this theme, and they focus more than anybody else does on the human rights of refugees and internally displaced persons. So very significant meetings at the United Nations.
Then, of course, on Wednesday, the 21st, the Pope's weekly general audience.
Absolutely. And it was interesting because the Holy Father on Wednesday before, there was a big threat of rain. So a number of people who were ill, disabled people, et cetera, were brought to the Paul VI Hall. And he did meet them before he went out to the square. This is the Year of Mercy. The Pope has been talking about mercy. And he referred to St. Luke's Gospel of how the Lord calls us to be merciful. We must be loving, giving, forgiving, and pardoning. And that was really the main message and focus of that catechesis. And he said, Jesus is called to humankind to be as merciful as the Father, which, of course, is the theme of this Year of Mercy. He said, it's not a question of quantity. It's a summons to be, for us, to be signs, channels, and witnesses of his mercy. And then also Wednesday, we did hear of the horrible, tragic death of two Mexican priests who had been kidnapped and subsequently killed. And we just learned that another priest has been killed in another Mexican city, and the bishop has obviously asked for his release, fearful that the same end will come to these priests. So these were two priests were abducted from their church in the state of Veracruz, in the city of Poza Rica, and their bodies with bullet wounds were found the following day. And then Thursday was a very big, important day for us in communications, actually, because the Holy Father met with the Italian National Council of the Order of Journalists. It was a really amazing talk. And at about the same time he was addressing this Council of Journalists, the statute for the Vatican's Secretariat for Communications was published. But just to go back to the Holy Father's talk, this is a profession that should have high ethical standards because of its effect on society. And the Holy Father said there's three things that are essential to their work, to our work. He said truth, professionalism, and respect for human dignity. Francis said there are few professions that have so much influence on society like that of journalism. And he said, in essence, if you look at it, you are really there when we write the first draft of history, building of the news agenda, introducing people to interpretations of events. And then he looked a little more in depth at each one of these three qualities. He said loving the truth means not only stating it, but living it, bearing witness to it in our work. He said, even in journalism, we must be able to discern between shades of gray surrounding the events we are called to tell. And on professionalism, he said, when there was professionalism, journalists remained a cornerstone, a fundamental element for the vitality of a free and pluralistic society. And then, of course, this was so powerful. On the element of human dignity, the Holy Father reiterated earlier comments he'd made about rumors being a form of terrorism. And he said how he noted how you can kill a person with language. And he said one or two of his morning homilies, actually, on these various topics. And he went on to say, journalism cannot become a weapon of destruction of people and of even nations. So a powerful, powerful talk.
Well, thanks, so, Joan. I'm afraid that's all we have time for today,
yeah.
But I do appreciate you coming in, and I'll see you next week. Bye-bye. And thanks there to Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome. And that's all we have time for today. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Until next time, bye-bye. Laudator Jesus Christus.